Blog Talk Radio.
To get something you never had, to bring balance to your life, to change your interactions, to be re-energized mentally, to have a positive influence on your daily choices. Bring back the hippie in that sweet surprise of life. Be able to relate to your own, a baby boomer generation, a generation that's dreaming, a baby boomer generation, a generation that's with a youthful spirit, maintaining an energetic mental state at all times, always moving, always focus on the journey. This is your time. This is your moment. This is your show. My Soul, Redefining Aging Lifestyle. And let's get it, BBGs. Good evening. We welcome each one of you. Today is February 12th, 2015, and you're listening to My Soul, where we are redefining aging and lifestyles. My name is Free, the poet, and we are the Baby Boomer Generation, otherwise known as BBG. We are doing what? Aging to live. Hear us roar. Meow. That means, of course, that was our opening intro. My Soul, and we're going to jump back in to continue with our month-long focus on history in the narrative form, and we will continue to offer awareness in the form of personal power. We're beginning this year with a focus on, we begin the year with a focus on rebalancing as it applies to our lifestyle, and so now, in our second month, we're focusing on just history because this is Black History Month. So, but otherwise, feel free to contact me at any time at Twitter. My handle is at BoomerFree or www.blogtalkradio.com/mysoul, where you may also find my website information on the top right-hand corner, right under the tag. And listeners, as always, feel free to call in and talk with me at 347-637-3466. Again, that number is 347-637-3466. This, again, is Free, your host. Let's jump right in. On the menu this evening, we have masala chicken and savory stuffed sweet potatoes with white beans and kale, paired with a cup of chamomile tea. Yum, yum. Some kind of good. All right. So let's go ahead and let's talk about and get into our African-American history timeline.
I will call into the past. Far back to the beginning of time. And beg them to come and help me. At the judgment. I will reach back and draw them into me. And they must come. For at this moment, I am the whole reason they have existed at all.
Now
I know you'll understand me.
I want to
Penelope.
Tonight, we're focusing on African American art. The article of research was taken from an excerpt from Africana, the Encyclopedia of the African American Experience, the second edition, which was edited by Henry Louis Gates Jr. and Kwame Anthony Appiah in April of 2005. But this article was written by a professor at Duke University, Richard J. Powell. Let's start with the first area. During the Harlem Renaissance, there was social and political anxieties that many African Americans felt just after World War I, somewhere between 1914 and 1918, that were alleviated in part by mass migrations to the urban northern cities. Often, a respite from the repressive attitudes and mandates of the old Southern order. And these new racial compositions of cities like Washington, D.C., Philadelphia, New York, Pittsburgh, Detroit, Chicago, and St. Louis, in combination with a heightened social consciousness and a seemingly unbound desire for leisure and escapism. Now, this doing this Harlem Renaissance, as the cultural movement later became known, was realized by a mix of American movers and shakers, social reformers, political activists, cultural elites, progressives in public policy and education, and, of course, artists. So although each of these constituencies had its own reasons for promoting African-American achievements in the literary, musical, visual, and performing arts, the collective results of these endeavors was an unprecedented broad-based focus on African-Americans, their art, and their connections to a larger modernistic vision. Now, visual artists played a key role in creating depictions of the new Negro alongside their counterparts in literature, music, and theater. Painters Palmer C. Hayden, Melvin Gray Johnson, and Laura Wheeler Waring, among others, exhibited bold, stylized portraits of African Americans during this period, as well as scenes of black life from a variety of perspectives. Now, sculptors such as Richmond Bart Day, Sergeant Johnson, and Augusta Savage used clay and wood and bronze to create comparable representations. Now, book and magazine publishers of the 1920s and the 1930s also helped to disseminate the Harlem Renaissance imagery. They published in the pages of The Crisis, Opportunity, and New Masses, where the block print illustration of James Lassene Wells, the etchings and drawings of Albert Alexander Smith, and the illustrations and jacket covers of one of the period's most prolific artists, Aaron Douglas. Now let's talk about the arts and crafts during that colonial, federalistic, and antebellum years. During the American infancy in the period between 1600 and early 1800s, what one would describe as the African-American art indeed embraced a range of forms and definitions. A small drum, several wrought iron figures, dozens of ceramic face vessels, and a few examples of domestic architect found among enslaved black communities in the southern United States have been singled out for their similarities with comfortable crafts, functional objects, and structures in West and Central Africa. In contrast, black artisans like the New Orleans-based engraver Scipio Moorhead and the Baltimore portrait painter Joshua. But now, during the Great Depression and World War II years, as the debates among artists and intellectuals around a racially representative art shift to discussions about social responsibility and a folk identity, artists like Aaron Douglas increasingly turned to the public arena as a means of addressing art and life in the 1930s. Now, Douglas painted murals for schools, libraries, and YMCAs. YMCAs exemplified the shift towards the social, as did the colorful, compositionally rheumatic easel paintings of Archibald J. Motley Jr. Now, many artists in the 1930s who had begun their careers during the Harlem Renaissance and under the auspices of philanthropic organizations like the Harmon Foundation now made art under the auspices of the Federal Art Project, otherwise known as FAP, for the Works Progress Administration. These artists like Alan Rowan Crite, Ernest Criclow, Doc Thrash, embraced a visually conservative but politically radical figurative art in which the themes of poverty, racial discrimination, and a growing social consciousness took center stage. This newfound fascination in the art world with the masses resulted in an expanded appreciation for those artists, black and white, who had not attended art school, whose art was often unsophisticated, and who functioned on the margins of the art scene proper. Now, one of these so-called folk artists, the Tennessee stone carver William Edmondson, was honored in 1937 with a one-person exhibition at New York's Museum of Modern Art. He was the first African-American artist to receive that distinction. Now, the tensions between art that referred to people's social conditions and art that transcended race and class politics are represented by the works of two artists that were active during the 1860s and the 1870s, sculptor Edmonia Lewis and a landscape painter, Robert Scott Duncanson Lewis. Lewis, who studied art at Oberlin College independently in Boston, Massachusetts, and among American and British expatriates in Italy, used the artistic conventions of neoclassicism to create powerful marble statuaries on the subjects of Black American emancipation, female oppression, and Native Americans. Duncanson, working mostly in Cincinnati, Ohio, and other locations in the Ohio River Valley, painted dreamy pastoral scenes that recalled the aesthetics of the Hudson River School, rather than overly racial and political themes. Now, yet, the racially tinged ordeals that both of these artists grappled with at various points in their careers gave even their most apolitical portrait, bust, and landscape allegories a social dimension, thus justifying the African-American designation of their work. A similar political and apolitical bifurcation is present in the work and lives of artists working between the years 1865 and 1900. The first against the social backdrop of enfranchisement and hope, and later against one of disenfranchisement and despair, was a landscape painters like Edward Mitchell Bannister and William Harper. They created the mood, Barbizon School-like scenes, bereft of the political jockeying and white-on-black violence that characterized African-American lives at the end of the century. Now, for painter Henry Ossawa Tanner, the pressures of American racism and the burdens of representing his race were too great. And so his 1891 move to Paris, France, encouraged his interest in painting mostly biblical scenes in a part academic, part symbolistic manner. In contrast, in Athens, Georgia, a seamstress by the name of Harriet Powers, oblivious to the world of art galleries and exhibitions, created at least two powerful Bible quilts that bore strong similarities to West African textile arts, especially to the cloth appliques from the Akan and Fon peoples. Increasingly, heroic and uplifting portrayals of African Americans appeared in paintings and sculptures in the first two decades of the 20th century. Now, artist Edwin A. Harleston was renowned for his paintings of distinguished and affluent Black Americans. Sculptors Isaac Scott Hathaway and May Howard Jackson also dedicated much of their careers to creating portrait busts of African-American notables past and present in the pages of the journal The Voice of the Negro. The artist John Henry Adams Jr. created dozens of African-American portraits, finely drawn and idolized in the manner of the white illustrator Charles Dana Gibson, but informed by emerging racial consciousness. In the more symbolic and allegorical works of the sculptor Meta Warrick Fuller, a Black cultural connoisseur manifested itself in important 19th century topics, such as emancipation, and in pieces that foreshadow several themes that would be important for artists and intellectuals in subsequent years. The African past, a Black cultural rebirth, etc. Now, Johnson created art that, despite occasional portrayals of Black subjects, was conceived in a thoroughly Western European fashion. Other workshop or academically trained African American artists prior to the American Civil War, which was 1861 to 1865, New Yorkers Patrick Reason and William Simpson, a Philadelphian Robert Douglas, and the New Orleans and Paris based brothers Daniel and Eugene Warburg also created works of art that were indistinguishable from those of white printmakers, painters, and sculptors. Now let's talk about the abstraction and the realism during the post-war years. This balancing act between a race consciousness and art and visual assimilation into the white cultural mainstream exemplified most emphatically in a non-figurative abstract art. It was undermined by several artists in the post-World War II years. The work of these artists, decidedly abstract and expressionistic, yet at times referential to Africa, Black America, and to the evolving civil rights struggle, necessitated an altogether different definition of what was then described as a modern Negro art, a form of modern Negro art. At the forefront of this new paradigm was Hale Wathrop, whose integration of African design motifs into his colorful large-scale canvases stood alongside an enigmatic and symbol-laden painterly abstraction in works by other painters. In the midst of this moment, when abstract art was considered the status quo, several figurative artists, among them Huey Lee Smith and Charles White, achieved broad recognition. Lee Smith painted desolate urban landscapes inhabited by solitary people of different ages and sexes and across the racial spectrum, while White, whose career dated back to the 1930s, produced in the 1950s a series of monumental crayon and ink drawings of idolized African-American figures. These works, when thematically framed by the news reports of civil rights, bus boycotts, lunch counter sit-ins, and attacks on Black protesters by angry whites, took on an even greater power than their abstract counterparts in explicitly communicating something about African-American aspirations and dreams. The two 1960s artists whose career and products may be considered to have formed the bridge between the visual past the omnipresent Black figure overtures to visual modernism and the need to acknowledge the politics of race and a visual future for African-American art, artistic singularity over racial unity, narrational, perceptual, and the interjecting of class, gender, and sexuality into art was two people by the name of men, by the name of Bob Thompson and Romare Bearden. The colorful silhouette and enigmatic figures in Thompson's paintings derived from the works of the old masters of options in African-American visual culture. Similarly, the cut-up, collaged, and reconstituted images of Africa-America that Bearden introduced to the public in 1964 inaugurated an expanded and progressive view of art and art-making, a picture that reflected ambiguity, complexity, nuance, and affirmation in Black culture, the Black arts movement, abstraction, and beyond. Art's capacity to endow the artist, viewer, and others with self-affirmation and a sense of, cultural authority became the benchmark for the Black arts movement of the late 1960s and early 1970s. Now, during this period, African-American writers, performing artists, visual artists, made Black culture and the political struggles of Black people worldwide their raison d'etre. Slogans like Black is Beautiful, Black Power, as well as jazz and soul music, became the soundtrack for works by painter Murray DePillis, mixed media artist Ben Jones, and muralist Dana Chandler. Jeff Donaldson, a co-founder of the Chicago-based Black artist collective Afra Cobra, not only added to this milieu of his own African textile-inspired mixed media works, but he wrote influential art manifestos and helped organize international expositions of Black artists in Africa and North America. Many artists whose careers extended back to the 1930s and 1940s resurfaced with a renewed sense of racial solidarity and political insurgency during the Black arts movement. Painters Louis Malou Jones, John Biggers, and sculptor and printmaker Elizabeth Cartlett all aligned themselves with the younger generation of Black artists, creating works that underscored their shared interests in African design sensibilities, the Black figure, and the continuing struggle for civil rights. Now, I want to talk to you a little bit about a tribute to a famous jazz and vocalist by the name of Little Jimmy Scott, who it came to my attention because his wife expressed some concern recently relative to a failure of the Grammys to mention his name in the memorial And Jimmy Scott passed last June of 2014. So tonight I wanted to close the show with one of his many songs, and his name was James Victor Jimmy Scott, also known as Little Jimmy Scott. He was an American jazz vocalist, famous for his unusually high contralto voice and his sensitivity on ballads and love songs. And you're going to note this in his voice when he sings. It almost sounds like a female, but this is Little Jimmy Scott. Enjoy, and I'll be right back at you. And inspire you with great information and to help you. And we thank and appreciate you for taking the time to listen and to participate in sharing in this dance of redefining who we are and how our spirits dance, my soul. Join us every Thursday at 6:30 p.m. for a premier dinner hour where there's always something good on the menu and a great meal topic. Keep aging to live, keep moving, keep dancing, have a safe, happy weekend, and I'll talk to you next week. Well, we really are going to flabbergast you next week. See you later. Little Jimmy Scott with When Did You Leave Heaven?
Why did they let you go?
see.